Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman.
I'm Bianca Bremen.
And I'm Lara Chan Baker.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast from the Jackie Winter Group. We're a creative production and representation studio based in Melbourne and New York City. This podcast is an opportunity for our two studios to come together each week and provide an insight into the creative industry from our unique point of view as a bridge between clients and creatives. Using the internet as our lens, we hope to explore a variety of current events, opinions, and tools to provide thought-provoking conversation for anyone whose job it is to bring creative things to life. Remember that this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using the podcast, Overcast, or Castro podcatchers, you can directly link to the articles discussed here as well as get enhanced visual content as we move along. This season, we're rolling on with our extended open tab segments that you know and love. This week, we're in full flashback mode. The dream of the 90s is alive in dial-up BBSs. How an ancient art form inspired Jackie Winter. Bianca discusses the golden age of computer motion graphics from the 80s, and Lara goes way back to the 60s to unearth some spy gems from the archives of the NSA. Much like our IRL Open Tabs events, which you can find out more at opentabs.rodeo, we're digging deep into the JW network of amazing people to contribute their own link and thoughts to each episode, and today, we're delighted to welcome, actually, you're pretty in our network, but you're still a special guest. Welcome, Bianca, to the office, physically. How are you?
Hello. Yes, I'm here, physically, in the flesh.
So
it's very exciting.
I mean, usually I record from my desk in New York, but here today I am in Melbourne.
In the morning, not recording at night.
Not after spin class, as we were just discussing before.
How we're all squished into our hot box together. It's lovely. It's intimate.
Yeah. Podcast well, sauna.
It's great to have you here on your annual visa pilgrimage before you head back into run things back in New York.
Yes.
Have you had a good trip? What have you noticed? Is there anything, has Melbourne changed at all in the last year?
Well, no, as I was saying to you the other day, it's like everything's the same. It just has like a new lick of paint.
A new lick of paint.
Yes. Nothing's changed. Still can't get a good cup of coffee. And by good, I mean a shit cup of coffee. So.
Fair enough.
You've changed. How are you, Jeremy?
I'm sick. I just kind of saying
sick, like fully sick.
Yeah, fully sick. Yeah. But also physically sick.
Yeah, just ill, unwell. Yeah,
unwell. The struggle is real.
Just for dramatic effect. Yeah.
It's just like I was
saying.
You
cannot catch a break.
Cannot catch a break. I've been in hospital in general anesthesia once a year for the past 5 years, and I just feel like between kids, injuries, being sick. It has just been, you know, it's been full on.
You'll get through it.
The show must go on.
We believe in you. The show must go on. You're a true showman.
Lara, what about you?
I'm good. I just got back from Sydney. I was there for the amazing Audiocraft podcast festival. I have to say, yeah, they've just done such a fantastic job. There were too many highlights to mention, but I do have to give, of course, a shout out to our amazing producer, Areej, who spoke so wonderfully on the Saturday at the conference. Yeah, she's incredible. It was great to sort of sit and watch her do her thing rather than just sort of being annoying and asking for edits late at night. She was absolutely fantastic. The whole festival was fantastic. So feeling jazzed.
Fantastic. And yeah, you said that you were single-handedly now make this podcast 3 million times better just because you went, right?
Just going to back away slowly.
Are any of the sessions on were recorded or can people find them?
Yes. So a bunch of, not the workshops, but the conference sessions were recorded and they're going to be released on the Audiocraft podcast. So if you just subscribe to Audiocraft on whatever podcatcher, then you can get those in a couple of weeks when they go up. And I highly recommend it. They were really good. I know that some sessions weren't recorded, but most of them were. And there were, a lot of really, really awesome people speaking very intelligently and insightfully about a lot of things.
Excellent. Okay. Well, we're going to get right into our open tabs this week. You know, one of the things about open tabs, like, you know, sometimes we talk about a lot of things that are kind of the moment. And I thought it was really interesting today that a lot of the things that had come up that were in my tabs, at least, are kind of were things that were very kind of old. And so we're kind of doing a bit of a decade jump between each of us. And, you know, this has been something in my open tabs literally for kind of the past year, which is this documentary called BBS, The Documentary. And it was basically a DVD documentary about bulletin board systems, well, online bulletin board systems, some of the first kind of early communities of, you know, people on the internet using dial-up modems to gather and discuss around certain kind of special interest topics. And this was a really, I guess, huge part of my childhood in many ways. And when I found out this documentary existed, I was so devastated to find out that the DVD was sold out and you couldn't find it. But archive.org, which is kind of the Internet Archive and Wayback Machine, came to the rescue, and it is somehow kind of hosted there, all 8 parts of this kind of documentary, which is fantastic. And the one link that I want to specifically talk about today is part 5 in this documentary, which specifically goes into the ANSI art scene, especially kind of a few groups of artists who were running BBSs, and they were called Acid and Ice, and they were in all caps with a lowercase I. And, you know, these, to people of a certain age and of a certain inclination, this is going to be bring back a lot of memories. But for people who maybe have completely missed that or of a different generation, Lara, might have absolutely no idea kind of what this is.
And, yeah, nah, I've got no idea what this is, got to be honest.
Well, it's all just acronyms right now.
Yep.
So, look, there's a certain bit of kind of nostalgia that made me kind of, you know, want to watch this. And the reason it's been in my tabs for so long is because I just kind of, I don't really like watching kind of long form video on my computer. So I kind of will keep something open and watch it for 10 minutes kind of here and there because there's a lot of content there. But yeah, just to give a bit of, I guess, overview, this particular episode focuses on the computer art scene. And we're going to post a few links to kind of Wikipedia to put these things in context because it's a very kind of visual thing that you have to kind of get your head around to know. But these BBSs were effectively other computers, usually in just kind of people's homes, and you would literally kind of dial into them. And the amount of modems or phone lines you had kind of would affect how many people kind of dial in. So usually it was just kind of one-to-one. You'd have to find these phone numbers like in specific kind of places. Usually there was a magazine called 2600 and they would kind of be listed there. And they were like these little kind of back streets of the internet. And you would dial up on your kind of modem and you would get this kind of text display of kind of what this bulletin board was about. A lot of them were for pirating kind of software back in the day. Sometimes they
like
were
even back in the mid 90s or early 90s.
Oh yeah. And it would take days to do it. Like if you want, I remember, and people had to go through these extreme lengths. So like, for example, if you wanted like a game, like the Escape from Monkey Island, for example,
and that was Paperboy.
On like, no, yeah, even that, like it would be kind of disc and disc that were uploaded. And, you know, those discs were only kind of like, I don't know, 1.5 kind of megs, but they would take, you'd have to take days to download. And if you only had a phone line, that means like, you know, your parents couldn't use the regular phone and like you would get disconnected. And like, there's so many kind of things that will trigger certain people, like if you really start thinking about it. But for me, you know, this is kind of really what got me into illustration in so many ways. I mean, I was always kind of into art and, you know, from started with me with kind of sports teams logos. But once I got kind of into BBSs, there were these kind of groups that evolved. And these groups would basically design these amazing kind of like splash pages, effectively, which were kind of scrolling bits of what was called ANSI art. And basically what ANSI art is, it's kind of rectangular blocks of either solid color or kind of a halftone of a color. And the way that people could make these incredibly elaborate kind of scrolling images to kind of, that would basically be the welcome page to the certain BBS that you were on. A whole kind of community of artists kind of developed around that, and people, you know, build tools to actually kind of make these illustrations and these pieces. And it got to the point where you had these little kind of gangs almost, but they were kind of called art groups, and every month they would release different art packs. And so the two major ones were Acid and Ice. They were, Acid was called ANSI Creators in Demand, and Ice was called Insane Creators Enterprise. And it's amazing that like of when this came out and how this was kind of documented, a lot of these people were just kind of names at the time. So watching this documentary was really interesting in terms of putting actual kind of faces to the names and for people that I kind of knew and revered as kind of gods growing up, and then just to see them as kind of like 40-year-old dudes like living somewhere in California, just like totally normal.
But, so were you a part of one of these groups?
Well, yes, I was.
What was your handle? Do you want to reveal that?
That will never, ever get revealed in any way, shape, or form.
Damn, that just like confirms that it's really embarrassing.
It is incredibly embarrassing. I need to actually.
Oh, I need to know this so badly.
I'll give you a very tangentially related hint in that it involves Andrew Lloyd Webber in some way.
Why?
People sing? No, that's not Andrew Lloyd Webber.
No. Anyway, I was a huge, huge nerd in kind of so many ways.
And
still am in many, many ways. But I think that this kind of work is so, so important to kind of look at. And it has a lot of kind of, I guess, repercussions on me personally. Like that's how I kind of feel that ANSI art really helps spark my own interest like in art and in Jackie Winter like many years later. And I kind of think that if this is something that I'm talking about and you have no idea what I'm talking about, go to the links that we're putting in the show notes or look at kind of some of the content that will be in our enhanced content, because I mean, you have to put this kind of stuff in context in terms of how it was created, like literally kind of point by point. Lara, you've never heard of this before, ever?
Yeah, no bloody clue. And I was no clearer after reading the Wikipedia article you sent through. Like, I'd love to find a better explainer somewhere that we can put up for people. I'm glad you did a bit of an explainer, because now I think I am definitely clearer. And it's stuff that I have seen before but not necessarily known what it was. Like, I've seen it. It's popped up not during its peak or anything, because I was either not alive or a baby. But yeah, this is all pretty new to me. And it's also just like a real weird insight into you, which is like great and terrifying.
Well, do you know what I think is interesting is like kind of thinking about this time in internet culture. And, you know, it kind of reminds me of like someone like Justin Meller and his artist collective, or even Craig and Carl and Adrian Clifford and Rilla Alexander.
These are all artists on our roster.
Yeah. Who we represented, Jackie Winter.
I should just say that Justin Meller's group was called Deathcore.
Deathcore.
And then obviously Craig and Carl and Rilla, their group was Rinzin. The five people, but Deathcore was like a kind of multinational, international thing, very similar to Ice and Acid, actually.
Yeah, I mean, it's like artists that are kind of, I don't know, are they doing monthly challenges or they're just kind
I mean, yeah, they were doing monthly packs, basically. And I'm going to link to the Ice site, which actually goes through all the packs from the early 90s. And they are still making packs today, which is crazy. I mean, the work is totally different. It's much more kind of contemporary, like Justin's work and those deathcore artists. You know, I was talking to an artist yesterday just about this, looking at their folio and about how making self-initiated work is just so important, but it's so hard in isolation, and like you need a community because you need to have kind of people to be accountable for. So it was so interesting at the time because like everyone was trying to one up each other in terms of making these
doing
graphics.
And they were doing collaborations. Like, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I saw Rinzin speak, I think when I was studying, this would have been over 10 years ago. And I remember them talking about like their kind of like Exquisite Corpse sort of projects where they would do a digital piece of illustration and then pass it on to the next person. And they would like add to it or remove it. It would end up being something collaborative that everyone kind of touched, but might have, you know, like from where it started and where it finished, it was a completely different piece of work. And I think that was happening in some of these art collectives as well.
Yeah. The thing that really strikes me is just how restrained the tools were and how that kind of opened up creativity. Like, you literally had a choice. Like, you had a certain amount of lines that you were doing. You were designing kind of things by pixels. Like, you had to kind of place either a rectangular or a square pixel there, and you could choose the color, and you could choose the halftone, which was like kind of in 10 densities. And the way that people could take that limitations and make something from it was amazing. And I think, you know, in today's climate where you have so many kind of tools available, it's overwhelming. I love that like restraint brought about some really kind of amazing creativity, which I see reflected today. Like, you look at something like Minecraft, which is almost kind of very kind of similar. Like, you could say that Minecraft is almost like ANSI art, but in the third dimension where you're able to go up instead of kind of back and forth and have kind of depth to it. But like, Minecraft is a very basic aesthetic of kind of building blocks. And I think, yeah, there's just this inherent need. If you put these kind of blocks in front of people want to build stuff with it. I guess the point that I'll kind of close on, which is another kind of related link in my open tabs, and I'm really curious to see if you guys saw this as well. This was a piece, I mean, it was on, I'm linking to a Dig article, but it was kind of everywhere. And it was a portrait of this kind of woman, and it was made entirely with HTML and CSS. Have you seen this at all?
No.
It looks like a crazy kind of oil painting, but it's actually all kind of done in code. So, you know,
I did see this. Was everywhere. And then people were putting it into different like browsers to see how, oh yeah, this is great.
The concepts have kind of grown, and I guess the languages have changed, but like, yeah, you would never kind of actually want to create a piece of art like, you know, doing this. This was kind of more of a technical exercise to see if this person could do it. And they did do it. And if you haven't seen this, please look at this. It's kind of amazing.
I, like you, Jeremy, actually kind of owe my career to kind of this sort of thing. Like, I mean, I had the internet back in, I think I was in year five, and it would have been about 1996. We had the internet. And so I like was very familiar with, I think I tried to create my own bulletin board system, which like obviously didn't go anywhere. But I was just like, I don't know why I was like exploring like the notion of just like actually creating like a bulletin board system like on my little 486 in my bedroom. But I remember like just kind of like pixel art. Like, I don't know, Lara, if you're familiar with this, there was the Palace Chat, and there were these little avatars called Dolls with a Z. And, you know, that you'd have this like little...
I screenshotted Dolls into Slack like a month or two ago because someone reminded me, and I'd completely forgotten about it. I spent hours and hours making this thing.
I kind of love that. And I think about like today, like it was just this little avatar that was pixel art, and he had this base, which was this like naked figure, and you could add, like just using pixels, you added like hairstyles or you added clothes, and, you know, you could like create your own little avatar. Whereas like now we have that, what's that emoji thing that you use?
Bitmoji.
Bitmoji. Like, I feel like, but I mean, it's so funny because, like, I remember growing up, I think in about year eight, I actually won a competition in my English class because instead of submitting my book report, thank you, Lara, instead of submitting my book report, like, as like a printed book report, I actually coded my own website. Like, I, you know, I taught myself HTML and CSS and I did that. And, you know, I had like my own little like sort of pixel graphics and whatever. And I just think it's so funny now because, like, I mean, that's kind of, I guess, the reason why I went into study multimedia design. But it's funny because now I'm so, like, I talk a lot about like how much I dislike the internet, but I think part of it is because we've sort of like, we don't have this kind of like analog way to create things anymore. Like, I don't know what it is, but like, yeah, a Bitmoji compared to
back in my day,
this like little pixel avatar, which, like, you know, you kind of like create yourself. It just feels like very different. Now they've got the talking emojis that they're just released.
Animoji or whatever.
Well, no, now they're like, well, Apple just had their WWDC 2 days ago and the animojis were animated emojis and now you can animate your own, like you'd get your own face. You know, anyway, technology, hey, that's that. We should actually just rename the podcast. Look, like, if this is something that you haven't really heard about, like, it's a real deep rabbit hole to get into. So I highly recommend checking this out. Let's move on. Bianca, you've got our second link today, moving a bit further back into the 80s, but something that actually just only popped up kind of last week on, I know, your preferred social network or platform, LinkedIn. Tell us a bit about Scanimate.
So this came up, I was scrolling through LinkedIn and this came up. It's a tiny little documentary. It's about 15 minutes long and it's called Scanimate, The Origins of Computer Motion Graphics. And I just was kind of stopped in my track. So I studied multimedia design and part of my course was animation and motion design, but I went to a technical college. So we didn't really learn any history. It was all really about like application and actually making things. And I was just completely stopped in my tracks because I'd never thought about the fact that an analog machine could create motion graphics. And so I was just like, whoa, what the hell? So Scanimate is a machine that's like an analog machine that creates motion graphics. And a lot of the traditional kind of motion graphics that we sort of know today came from this machine. So the idea that you could actually fly a logo onto frame and promote a brand really happened with this machine. And it started in actually 1960 in an attic in Pennsylvania with glass tubes and colored wires. And there was this guy and he was at home watching television. And when he turned off the television, you know how like the TV kind of just goes, and like the whatever, I don't know, like the light just kind of like goes down into a dot. And he was like, oh, well, that's just the deflection circuits. They're just collapsing. So he was like, oh, you know, if I can manipulate those, then I can create animation. And so this machine is like a lot of plugs and it's literally like the, if you know anything about motion graphics and if you've kind of used After Effects is just really like a base where you can animate things, but then there's plugin after plugin to give you effect after effect. And this is basically what this machine is kind of able to do, is animate like a logo or an effect. And it actually started, they were just doing kind of spirographic pattern animations. And then when they were like, oh, this thing's cool, like we can create animation in real time. And so it was actually, it kind of uses like projection and an actual camera to film onto tape whatever you're capturing, and then you're manipulating using, like, you know, all of the plugs, like a soundboard or a mixing board. Like, you're actually manipulating the visuals while you're creating things. And when they were like, oh, okay, so how do we monetize this? And this some guy from IBM, this sales guy that they'd hired, was like, oh, well, if you can, you know, add words and move words, like maybe this has a commercial application. And so that's kind of where motion graphics, I mean, I guess the alternative was cell animation, which is really cumbersome and can be quite tedious. Like, actually having, you know, you almost have like the client gives you a stencil and you almost like project that like into this machine, and then you can manipulate it. And it's this beautiful kind of like 80s motion graphics look and feel where you've got like the blooms and like the light spills and like all of this nice kind of artifacts that you cannot, I mean, everyone's like trying to achieve now in 2018 using After Effects.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very kind of similar to any kind of analog synthesis, like especially if you look at kind of music, for example. Like, there's a whole crazy way that sounds can get generated, and then those kind of sounds are then kind of modulated from there. So it's so interesting to see that these tools actually existed for motion. I actually had no idea before I saw this. So, you know, kind of some of it. I think the the tricks that are kind of actually used are in animation generally, like before kind of computers were around, were so amazing. And it's great that a lot of that kind of footage is being kind of unearthed now. Like, I don't know if you guys remember the original like, HBO animation, like if you had it here, but like, again, such a huge part of growing up that they would put it before each thing. And it was this crazy thing where it goes from like, it's this camera kind of flying in, like, you know, through this town and eventually like into kind of your living room, talking about the HBO journey. That was all done kind of by hand, basically. We had to kind of build the models. And so, yeah, it's interesting to see this kind of extension of that. Laura, yeah. What did you...
Yeah, I mean, like, again, it's totally before my time. You guys are dinosaurs, and I'm glad I'm here to keep you young and hip. But, you know, yeah, I mean, of course, it's occurred to me, like as Jeremy was saying, how animation in general was once created by analog means, but textual sort of motion graphics in this sort, in this style, yeah, I never would have guessed that it wasn't done digitally at some point. It's like, it's pretty crazy. And I think what I particularly love about this is the, there's a whole sort of section where they're talking about the like inherently unpredictable nature of Scanimate. Like they could sort of toy with all sorts of different things and achieve all sorts of amazing outcomes, but they could never be quite sure what those would be or like replicate it again. And it was like very unpredictable and surprising. And I love the notion of commercial work being full of such like irregularity and experimentation. And
well, I also think it was interesting, like part of using this machine was actually breaking it to create something new. Like the engineer was quite interesting in that, like, yeah, he was like totally happy with anyone kind of like just like tweaking and manipulating this machine and breaking it to get a certain effect, and then they would just put it back together. But I think what is interesting with this as well is that it's a physical desk that, you know, you have in an edit suite, and you can actually create animation in real time. And what I was kind of thinking about, and there's been a few conversations that we've had in the office, is with things like film and music production, where, you know, I've been around like smoke machines and flame machines, which are compositing desks that are kind of tied to software, where you actually can in real time, like they're pretty robust systems where in real time you can manipulate and you can composite. And you can do kind of like, you can do motion graphics in real time, and you have the client sitting in with you, and, you know, you can make changes very quickly. And, you know, obviously like when you're producing an album, it's a similar thing. Like you might have the musicians and the producers like in the room with you, but motion graphics and animation kind of in 2018, it feels like it's almost like a bedroom thing. Like, well, maybe, you know, over the last 10 years, it's kind of something that a lot of people have done in isolation. Like, do you think that, you know, we're kind of missing out on anything by not having like this kind of like really sort of performative and physical kind of collaboration between the client and the artist, like in like a edit suite or in like a room?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about, yeah, very much that idea of not being in the same room, because I mean, on most of the projects that we do, we aren't in the same room as client or even the rest of our team half the time, you know. So, and like, I think there are just pros and cons to it, you know, and it's a tricky one, because like there's all the pros of being in the same room, which is, you know, what you were saying, like how it can open things up for sort of more natural collaboration and really like quick sharing of ideas. And I think that's really positive. And quick decisions is another thing that's a major thing. And also, obviously, like it can mean that everyone's sort of just a bit more comfortable with each other. And if you feel a bit more like you're all on one team rather than a sort of us versus them kind of thing, like, you know, client versus supplier or whatever. And you know, sometimes being apart can like really overly formalize things in a way that is not helpful. But at the same time, like I think as well, one of the reasons that terrifies a lot of artists or a lot of editors or whatever it might be, being in the same room, is like the idea of just completely excess uncontrollable revisions, like, you know, which can be a bit insane.
And, yeah, but maybe being like physically next to someone might actually squash that a little bit, because you're there seeing the person actually making the changes in real time, rather than it being just like a quick time that you're viewing on your computer, where you kind of have this distance.
True. So you have a bit more sense of the amount of work that it actually takes, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perhaps. I think, yeah, that's definitely, that could be right. I think as well, like, there's that, so that people can just keep asking you, like, do this, do that, do
this. But it's also about like booking time rather than like, I guess, presenting creative value. Yeah. I don't know. That's an interesting thing too.
Look, it brings up a lot of really interesting points. And I just think the footage here is amazing. I don't know if this was produced by or for LinkedIn, but that's kind of where it lives. It's a very short clip. It's only around 16 minutes.
Well worth a watch.
It's definitely worth a watch, especially if you're, you know, just want to kind of see what these kind of tools look like and how they work. It's such a physical experience that you kind of really need to experience in a video. So yeah, highly recommend. We'll put it up in the show notes. Moving on is our final link of the week. And Laura, this is something that came in here at the last minute, but is something that's been around for a few years.
You're saying I do things at the last minute? What?
I would
Doesn't
never.
Doesn't sound like me.
Tell us about your link.
Yeah, we're getting back in the time machine. This is so cool. This happened just this week, very timely. the NSA, we all know the NSA, right? The US's National Security Agency. So, you know, all other things aside, this is actually very cool. So basically this transparency group called Government Attic sent a Freedom of Information Act request to the NSA back in 2016, and it was just finally fulfilled on Monday. So basically they uncovered this like insane haul of like 100 plus completely wacky motivational posters that the NSA developed in the 1950s and 60s to discourage employees from leaking secrets. It's so bizarre. It's all about sort of security and being tight-lipped and sort of not spreading confidential secrets and making sure to destroy confidential documents. But the way they've expressed this is bizarre. The breadth of styles is amazing. The concepts are amazing. The design, the layout work is so creative. It's so like visually arresting. And there's sort of this cultural savvy there that is quite surprising and like in some ways a bit ahead of its time, and then others it just feels so dated and weird. But what I love is that some of them are just like really explicit in what they're telling you, you know, not to do, and the imagery is very literal. And then others are just kind of subtle and insinuating and super strange. Like there's this one on page 29 that is just this like little splash shape in the lower half of the page, and in like really tiny writing it says "Be security conscious," but it's like really tiny. It's like not the focus of the poster. Most of the poster is just blank color. It's really bizarre. It's like, what? And yeah, like, you know, they kind of all look like these sort of independent art house movie posters or something.
It's so amazing. I mean, and we talk about the use of technology to kind of create work, and especially in pieces of graphic design like this, you know, where there's this mix of kind of hand lettering, photo collage, and other kind of ways that the type is kind of being set, like whether it's kind of monotype or phototype or anything like that, you do get this huge variation. But like people, yeah, like, I don't know, like my understanding was that this was something that was very kind of commonplace in public life. You look at something that has had so much penetration in the market, like the Keep Calm and Carry On poster, which is kind of, you know, well, a graphic poster that was kind of put like to get a kind of a public message out about, you know, how you should kind of behave in public life. And yeah, these are just, I mean, they're amazing.
They're amazing. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, I mean, security for the 70s.
There are literally almost how many hundreds?
There's like 100 and something of these. I think my favorite is the one on page 118, just says think. And it's just like, I don't know, it's just so beautifully designed. And the other one I love is page 91. It says make security your thing. And it's sort of like, got this like great text with sort of like a disco dancer in the middle. And it just feels so unlike anything I would ever imagine the NSA releasing. And yet somehow they did. And it's so crazy. And I just like, I was thinking about like, would this ever happen today? Like imagine if we got a brief to do this, like that would be coolest thing ever.
We'll link to this, but you know, we did a series of pieces for the Red Cross for plasma donation, which was kind of almost similar, almost around 20 or 30 artists, like to get people to donate their blood, which I think was kind of sort of similar. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we've had things like, I remember in New York after 9/11, there was, if you see something, say something, like all of, but like, you know, there was no, it was very kind of sterile. There was no kind of.
I mean, that's still in the subway. If you see something, say something, but it just looks like a government posted subway ad. Like, you know, it's just generic text. A stock photo.
Yeah, it's very government.
Yeah.
My favorite one is, it's not in this kind of list, but there's a particularly favorite movie of mine by David Mamet called The Spanish Prisoner. Have any of you guys seen it?
No.
It's amazing. But yeah, there's a whole office where they have kind of old posters there, and they have the loose lip sink ships poster. Have you seen that one? I mean, yeah, they're really kind of dramatic and scary.
But. Oh yeah, the creepiest one is definitely page 100, which when I say these page numbers, I'm talking about the actual full release document, which we'll link to. So the creepiest one is just this like sepia image of a toddler with his hands together, sort of like begging. And then at the bottom it reads, "In God we trust, in you we depend." And it's like actually terrifying.
So weird. Well, the weirdest one for me is I'm just looking at it now. It's like this kind of James Dean-esque illustration of this like gorgeous guy, like just the leaning on a safe lockbox, and it's just uptight and out of sight. Like it doesn't, I don't know, like I don't even know what it means.
They're so bizarre. And I just like anyone listening to this, go look at them immediately. Well, finish the podcast first, then go look at them immediately, because they're just they're insane. It's the best discovery in illustration in forever. I'm so happy about this.
And you found this on The Outline. That's a site that you particularly enjoy.
I'm obsessed. The Outline as well has to be hands down like the best designed editorial website I've ever seen in my life.
You heard it here first.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I find it overwhelming.
You're overwhelming.
I am overwhelming.
No, you're underwhelming. We'll talk about this later.
Okay, fantastic. We will put all of these links into our show notes as we do every week at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz, or also on our podcast-specific newsletter, which you can sign up to at tinyletter.com/jackiewinter. Moving on to our final topic, which is, you know, really kind of divorced from our original intention of like, let's lay out our problems and complaints and use our skills as producers to try to offer up some kind of solutions. It has blatantly just kind of ended up into us picking things that we want to complain about.
Give the people what they want, Jeremy.
Well, yeah, exactly. Fortunately, I don't have any more adhesive-related complaints to voice here. I will get things kicked off with a bit of a combined whinge slash social media slash justice campaign for the organization Ladies Get Paid. Now, I am not involved in this group directly. I know, I think Laura and Bianca,
actually, you're definitely on it. I went to the very first town hall meeting before Claire Wasserman, who runs Ladies Get Paid, actually. She was the marketing manager at Working Not Working, and they held a town hall about 2 years ago just for women to talk about, you know, inequality in definitely the creative space. And it's now a standalone organization called Ladies Get Paid, where they have monthly, you know, community meetups and workshops and resources. And there's a huge Slack community. And it was actually a really wonderful kind of thing for me to join when I first moved to New York, where Claire is based, and meet some wonderful people through that organization. Naomi Lacoste and Carly Ayers. Like, there's some nice shout outs of people that I actually met through this community.
Yeah. And I mean, their mission statement is clearly the founder to close the wage and leadership gap. And unfortunately, they have been sued by a crazy group of, I guess, men's rights activists, as it is kind of outlined all on this page called Ladies Get Sued, which you can find out a bit more about, you know, what has happened. And they're looking effectively for support, financial support, to back their legal case to help kind
of fight
this.
Yeah, they're a two-person startup. They have no funding. Like, it's completely devastating for them to be facing this, both like financially and also just like emotionally. You know, considering what they stand for and who they're being sued by, it's like the whole thing just makes me like incredibly angry and uncomfortable. And as Jeremy said, there's www.ladiesgetsued.com. Although no one says www anymore, do they? Ladiesgetsued.com.
I'm the old one.
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to relate to you, Jeremy.
HTTP.
Yeah. But yeah, you can go and contribute there, and we recommend that you do.
Yeah, they've already kind of actually over pledged from, you know, their $100,000 goal, which is amazing. They're trying to get 2,000 backers by June 12th, which will be probably after this podcast airs, but there's nothing wrong. You can still kind of contribute if you want to. I think, you know, it's a whinge because people that do this kind of legal action are just, you know, crazy.
Because men's rights groups are not a thing.
And well, yeah, I mean, this was happening a lot with kind of patent trolls and people who were kind of suing individual kind of podcasters, you know, because that people would say that they had the podcast on patents. You not know about this?
No.
It's a very kind of similar thing. So yeah, this is a lawsuit that has no kind of actual merit. This is a group definitely kind of worth fighting
for. I've just seen as well, really quickly, I'll mention on the website, they've got Ladies Get Sued, the podcast, where they've recorded a series of podcast episodes dedicated to the lawsuit, and as well as, like I said, a bit of a deeper discussion of the value of sort of safe spaces and the community of men's rights groups and how the law is sort of not always on their side, and it's very interesting.
That's actually amazing because, yeah, like you don't really get it. Like you see it a lot of these things, and it's so hard because once it turns into a legal fight, it stops you from kind of actually talking about it. So to see that there's, to see if there's an avenue there to explore that's fantastic. Laura, what is your whinge?
My whinge. I have a two-pronged attack today. I've been flying a lot recently. I have done like 6 flights in the last 2 weeks and nowhere far, just to like Sydney and Tassie and stuff. But it's just, been a few planes and on a lot of budget airlines. And my first complaint is about people who cannot get through security efficiently. Like by now, You should be unzipping your bags on the way up there.
No, got a counter whinge.
Let me finish my whinge. Let me finish my whinge. I was in line and this guy got one after the other, like separately sent back from the screeny thing for having, it was like keys, a lighter and his belt, like one by one. He did like, no, just fucking take off your belt. Like it's not that hard. And it was so annoying. And he was also holding up the whole line because like he didn't take his laptop out. They literally like, there's like 4 people yelling at you to do those things as you walk up. Like it's not difficult.
It is difficult.
And no.
I hate anything to do with security. Like
I don't enjoy it, but
no,
like,
but it can be a little bit confronting. And if you've never flown before, if you're not English, like, you know,
he was like a businessman, like he's flown. Like, no fucking sympathy. I have no sympathy for anyone who flies in a suit. And I just, I don't know. But anyway, my second complaint is also to do with flying. they allow a carry-on sort of luggage thing for each person, right? Everyone's allowed that within the ticket that they buy. But for some reason, they don't allow for the space for everyone to have a carry-on bag. I specifically chose a seat at the front of the plane so that I could get on and off like quickly. And then when I got on, someone had put their giant fucking bag in my spot and my bag had to be put like 10 seats back. So then when we like went to get off the plane, I couldn't get off because my bag was back, and you can't go back while everyone's trying to go forward to get off the plane. It was so frustrating.
I mean, that's also frustrating when you turn up late and then they're like, oh no, no more room. You actually have to check in your carry-on. That's even worse.
And I wasn't even late. Like I was there perfectly on time. Just someone had a bag that probably shouldn't have been checked, like shouldn't have been carry-on, and it sucked.
Bianca.
You guys have no sympathy. I'm so mad about this. My next complaint is about you two.
Oh, I don't know. I'm staying with my parents at the moment and I have very specific tastes in coffee, and my coffee taste is the worst coffee that you can drink is probably the coffee that I'm going to love the most. So Melbourne has been very difficult because, you know, it's all espresso here.
Because the coffee's good.
Yeah, you know, and it's $6 for a pour over that, you know, you have to spend 15 minutes waiting for. But my dad has one of those machines, like the pod machines where you put the coffee pods
in.
Oh,
God, the Keurigs.
It's it's an Aldi version of the Keurig. I cannot for the life of me work out how to get the old pods out of the machine.
I remember I've had the same problem when I used to drink coffee in my old office.
I think I was like late to work yesterday because I couldn't. I was like, it was just like a nightmare. The coffee pods are stuck in there. I don't know how to get them out. I don't really have Wi-Fi at my parents' house to be able to Google this machine and look at the instructions. And I didn't want to call my dad because it was probably the easiest fix ever.
And that's the end of technology, hey?
Yeah. Jeremy, do you have an additional whinge?
No, I have no additional whinge.
Your life is perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, B. It's so nice having you in the studio. We'll see you next week back in New York.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lara.
No worries. Thank you.
Jackie Winter Gives You the Business is a weekly podcast about creative project management and production and just making things happen in general. Our producer is Areej Noor. You can find the Jackie Winter Group on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Jackie Winter. And you can email us with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com.
Oh, whinges about Jeremy Waltzman.
Indeed. We're also on Stitcher and Spotify, if that's your thing. To receive all of the links we talk about in the show each week in one neat little email, you can sign up to our podcast newsletter at tinyletter.com/JackieWinter, and archives of all of our shows and show notes can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Our theme music is by Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff at soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you love what you hear, you can really help us out by subscribing on iTunes, rating us, and commenting there too. I know there's a lot of people who get a lot out of this podcast, and we know from feedback from other guests and, you know, other amazing things, relationships that have been formed. So yeah, if you like what you hear, give us a comment. It really helps other people find out what we're doing and gives us some motivation.
Is this podcast bringing people together?
It is bringing people together. Indeed.
That's amazing.
I know. All the details are on our website at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye. Bye. Bye-bye.